There are hundreds of books on the shelves of libraries and bookstores on the subject of management, not a few of which deal with employees, personnel, people. These books are packed with steps, lectures, quick fix theories, and surefire ideas. Do they work? Well, people sure buy them. And if people buy them, there must be a need. And if there's a perceived need, you can pretty well guess there's a problem. Well, today on Conversations, we talk with a man who has made a career out of teaching others how to take the ordeal out of management. I'm Susan McGinnis. My guest is Sam Boyle. Trained by the Air Force in management and management education, Sam Boyle later linked up with Kenneth Blanchard and his management training and development company. You'll know the name Ken Blanchard if you know the phrase, one-minute management. And Mr. Boyle, who heads Boyle Consulting Services, now travels throughout the United States, Canada, Great Britain, and Australia, teaching, training, and helping companies develop good management. In the next hour, we'll talk about management, good, bad, indifferent, and ways to manage better, whether you're an owner, a supervisor, a worker, or perhaps a parent. Not to mention what we can look forward to and prepare for as the 20th century draws to a close. Stay tuned. Sam Boyle, what's the state of management today? Am I right that there must be a problem out there and that people are hungering for some sort of a fix?
I think that the answer to that is to look at the state of the world around us. Management, for better or for worse, is a reaction to your environment. It's a methodology or a system of organizing resources to achieve objectives. But nobody manages in a vacuum. Nobody manages in a situation that's free of constraints from the environment. So when we say that something's wrong with management, it's not so much that there's something wrong necessarily with the way we managed 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It's that those techniques no longer apply to a world that's changed. And all you have to do is take a look at the world situation and the rising levels of competition, changes in Eastern Europe, some of the competition that we're now seeing come online from Pacific Rim nations that we were content to ignore several years ago. Mm. And the reality is that the average American manager, be they in government, nonprofit, or working in a business somewhere, is being forced more and more to do less and less, in terms of resources. And so they're finding ways to try and stretch whatever they have to an extent that they probably would have imagined impossible 10 or 15 years ago. So is there a problem only in the sense that we're seeking new directions? I don't think it's so much an indictment as, gee, we've been wrong. Mm-hmm. It's times have changed.
You travel, but this is two questions in one. You laugh. You travel, what, did you say 3 days out of five, 5 days out of seven? I mentioned Great Britain, Australia, Canada, as mm-hmm. well as throughout the United States. Two questions in one, and you can answer them consecutively if you like. Is there a peculiar American management style? And if there is there an historic American style? You said times have changed in terms of what we do and in management. How have we been doing it in this country? And what of that needs to change?
I think that if there is historically an American philosophy of management, I think it's really just kind of almost an outgrowth of our culture. And our culture has always been based on the idea that we have unlimited expectations. Tomorrow will always be better than yesterday. And it's the notion that we'll raise our kids to have a better life than we had. And I think American management has certainly fed on that philosophy for many years. And so we're enamored with growth for growth's sake. And we're enamored with the idea that every year the returns are going to be better than they were last year. I sometimes think that on the one hand, while it's a significant advantage in that we don't undersell ourselves, sometimes it can become a disadvantage because our expectations may be too high. When you compare our management philosophies and approaches with those of other nations, and particularly in question I would think of is Canada, Great Britain, and Australia, those being the ones I have the most experience with, I would say that their expectations are somewhat less than ours, which is not to say they're diminished. I just think that they have a different approach. And maybe a real key to that is they don't believe necessarily that there's a solution for every problem. In America, on the other hand, and American management, we tend to believe that there's a fix for anything. If you throw enough money at it, or you invest enough time, or you pull together enough committees, then ultimately there's a solution for every problem. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. There are some problems that maybe are not solvable. There are some issues that are not going to be fixed simply by throwing money at them. And I think that's going to require us to really stop and evaluate where we want to put our time and our resources and decide which issues and which actions are going to pay off for us the best. So I think my answer in one part instead of two is that we are different. Mm-hmm. And that difference is sometimes a strength and sometimes a weakness, depending upon where we're at.
Do you think it makes an American nervous to think that a problem can't be fixed?
I think we get the jitters whenever we think that there's a problem that can't be fixed. Mm-hmm. Because we've always managed to solve every problem we've ever faced. And whether you want to go back in our history and look at transportation, the linking of the continent, or the exploration, or the improvements we made in agriculture or industry, all the way up to, probably the ultimate example was, putting a man on the moon. Mm-hmm. And the idea that if we focused our energy and our talents and our resources, we could achieve anything. The downside of that is that some would say it's perhaps made us a little bit arrogant in believing that we could solve any problem. And I'm not sure that that was true.
Does it also make us, and this is applying a specific to a generalization, but make us send up the Hubble telescope when its lens is not perfectly ground?
I would be real hesitant to comment, only in the sense that I don't have access to the data. Mm-hmm. In a generalized sense, maybe Hubble is a prime example of saving a penny and spending a dollar in response. Clearly the preliminary information seems to be that NASA felt like they were under the gun to get the project up and running, and they looked for places to cut, and one of the places they cut was inspection, mm-hmm. Which is tragic. Unfortunately, NASA is certainly not... It's not operating in isolation either. NASA is a reflection of American management as a whole. The difference is it's a public agency, so we pay an incredible amount of attention to them. The reality is you could probably find a half dozen examples, every bit as large and as terrible in their consequences, if you were to look closely at private industry. Mm-hmm. There's no difference.
20, 30 years ago, the Corvair, which its back blew up, was an example, perhaps.
Or the Ford Pinto. Uh-huh. If you want to play fair. And what's amazing to me, of course, is that when you stop and think about it, the Ford Pinto, the Chevy Chevette, the AMC Gremlin, that was our answer to the Honda Civic. It's kind of a frightening concept, to say the least.
This is Conversations. We're talking today to Sam Boyle. Sam Boyle heads Boyle Consulting Services. He has worked with and is an associate of Ken Blanchard's company, which is Blanchard Training and Development, Inc. You may know again the name Ken Blanchard. He developed the one-minute management theory and several books which have spun off from that theory. We'll talk about that theory in the next hour. I'm Susan McGinnis. Your specialty is management training and development in your working life. Is there a way to identify bad management? Does it show up in major signal ways?
I think the quickest, fastest way to ascertain whether management is good or bad. And again, there's some prejudice to that because it all depends on how you define good or bad. Mm-hmm. But I think the quickest way is to ask yourself the question, one, are the results there? Are we producing whatever results the organization is designed to produce? And at the same time, what's the condition of the people working inside that institution, and what's the condition of the people that are served by that institution? So I think you have to look at three factors to really make that decision. Because we can certainly find examples of organizations that technically are successful in the sense that they're generating wonderful results. However, the condition of the people that works there is abysmal. Or likewise, you can find, the counterpoint is you can find an example of a company doing very well in terms of looking after its own people, and yet it's going bankrupt. And so obviously there's a balance here somewhere. When I would go into an organization and make a determination as to where I think their management is at, then I think ultimately what that comes down to is trying to balance those three factors out. If it's a company, are they making a profit? Is it a realistic profit given the conditions of the market? Are the customers being served, and are they building long-term relationships where they're going to come back and do business with this firm in the future? And are the people excited, motivated, for lack of a better term, are they happy at whatever it is they're being asked to do? And if the answer to all three of those questions is yes, then I think obviously you found a winner. Mm-hmm. And if the answer is no to any one of those three, then I think you've probably got a potential problem. If the answer is no to two or more, then you have a serious problem.
Are there more winners out there than losers, or vice versa?
I'm inclined to believe there are a lot more losers than winners, and that's not a happy thought. I think there are a significant number of people who are unhappy with what they do, and that unhappiness has to be caused by something, and more often than not, I think what it is a reflection of the failings of the organization to really tap into the full potential that the people in the organization have. I think organizations tend to take on a life of their own, and as a result, people get diminished in the organization. They end up being less than, and for better or for worse, nobody wants to be a small cog on a big wheel. And unfortunately, it doesn't have to be that way. But unfortunately, it is for a lot of people.
Where are the blind spots?
There's a certain element of I've been there. There's a certain element of how to express that best would probably be I paid my dues, therefore so-and-so has to pay theirs. It was good enough for me, it's good enough for you. And so I think what happens is, and there's an element of greed. I continue to be shocked by just the blatant greed that sometimes seems to run amok in corporate America. But then corporate America is not isolated. I mean, we have scandals in the Congress. We have scandals mm-hmm. in government. We have, and somehow we've created a system whereby winning is the only objective. And the means that you use to get there are not all that terribly important. And an organization, be it a government agency or a business or non-for-profit, is a social animal. You know, it's designed to facilitate the interaction of people so that they can achieve something that collectively is possible and individually would be impossible. And so if you have a situation where some people are taking advantage of others, if you have a situation where some people are feeling that they're being devalued or that their contributions are less than, if you have some people who are profiting unfairly or out of proportion to their contribution, then I think obviously the social organism begins to fail. It of course, as they always say, the fish always rots at the head first, and so I think one's inclined to look at the upper levels of the leadership and ask the question, what are we doing right, what are we doing wrong? And unfortunately, you find a lot of wrong, which is not to say it's all bad. I certainly would not want to be categorized as one of the business bashers who seem to feel that anything that has business attached to it by definition is wrong. I think those people are just as misguided as the people who feel that anything that's pro-business is automatically good. But I do think that there is a lot of unfortunate circumstance that a lot of people find themselves in. And most of that can be laid at the feet of our institutions and our organizations.
And I suppose the global question, which we may be asking in different guises as the hour goes on, is transformation possible and how?
It is possible, but it's painful. And unfortunately, there are very few examples of any organization that has gone through that process of change without it being the result of an externally imposed crisis. Almost every success story that you bump into, I hesitate to use the E word or the excellence word because it's become so abused in the last decade, but almost every excellent story you hear is around company that has one way or the other, been driven to its knees by external competition and internal failings. And so ultimately it was the last gasp of breath and we miraculously turned ourselves around. And unfortunately, the sad part of that story is we don't seem to learn. For example, the automobile industry certainly wreaked havoc on itself over the course of the last two decades. Now, the fun part of that story is that at exactly the same time that the auto industry was going through its doldrums, and it's still there by and large, the arrogant engineers in Silicon Valley were stepping up to buy their Hondas and proclaiming that they had the world by the tail. Well, they committed exactly the same series of errors that were committed by the folks in Detroit. And, the funniest sight of all was to see the engineers, at Congress's door begging for protection a few short years later. It's as if the wheel had turned and come full circle. And I think what's frightening to me is that we don't seem to learn from other people's misfortunes. In our industry, we don't pay attention to what somebody else in other industries is doing, and so we commit the same mistakes over and over again. Government doesn't learn from business. Business doesn't learn from government. Non-for-profit it's kind of out there sometimes, it seems like, in their own world, not paying attention to what is happening in either end.
Mm-hmm. And creating a new wheel.
In essence, yeah. I mean, people feel like it's almost like they have a vested right to make the same mistakes that everybody else has made, because until they have, then they're not really sure that that's what's going to happen to them. And unfortunately, it's all too predictable.
This reminds me especially when you bring up nonprofits, of parents and kids. When kids are kids and their parents do something that is a gross insult to their kiddom, they generally say, I said, you probably said, when I grow up and have kids, I'm never going to do that.
Well, we take solemn vows.
Solemn vows. Very solemn vows. So, but when we are parents, we tend to follow the rhythms that were taught to us by our parents.
It's, you know, it's amazing. That's one of the fun things I sometimes ask people to do is, you know, I challenge them to go look in the mirror and ask themselves, you know, are you ever horrified to see your parents staring back at you? Mm. Because most of us are at one time or another. I think there's a certain amount of habit there. I think what happens is we tend to observe and absorb habitual patterns of behavior. And, you know, you can, if you want to, you can go back to the transactional analysis days and the scripts and all the roles, but without getting the deep end on that, the bottom line is that people do become creatures of habit. And we tend to display the same behaviors that we witnessed when the roles were reversed, which is where I was coming from earlier with the comment, you know, it's a, I've paid my dues.
Right.
And so we turn around and perpetuate the same injustices, inadequacies, you know, inefficiencies in our organization because we survived it. They'll survive it. Maybe in our defense, what we ought to say is that we lose sight of it. As soon as it's no longer impacting us...
Mm-hmm. I'm on the top, so...
Yeah, it's not so much the conscious decision not to care about other people or not to do, quote-unquote, the right thing, as maybe it is just a reaction of being unaware. We forget all too quickly what it was like to be in the trenches. Mm-hmm. And so we have a terrible tendency, I think, to perpetuate the same errors over and over again.
Let's get specific. What are some of those errors? And assuming that our manager is a well-intended manager who is not overly greedy and who does not think that I came up by my bootstraps and you better do it too or you're out. A well-intended manager committing errors, what are those errors?
Some of the more common ones probably first off would be, I think, is a fear of failure. I think that we have this terrible habit, you know, as Tom Peters sometimes says, once you take on the exalted title manager or supervisor, you immediately begin walking around like you've never committed a single error in your entire career. And so we role model perfection. And then we're shocked and surprised that people hide their mistakes or cover things up or don't participate in joint problem solving rather than going off and doing it themselves. And, you know, unfortunately, the downside is if you show me an organization isn't screwing something up now and then, I'll show you an organization isn't getting any better. So I think one of our first mistakes is we don't not only tolerate but almost, I want to say, encourage failure as part of our learning process. I think the second mistake that we tend to make that's somewhat related to that is I think we get into an entire almost game of always having the answer. The notion that with superior position comes superior knowledge. And the reality is that none of us is as smart as all of us. I'm not always an advocate of the committee or collective intelligence, but I think over the long term one can argue pretty successfully that most people kind of have a good feel for what's going on and with a little common sense could probably come up with reasonable solutions to most of the problems we face. The advantage of having people collectively thinking through the problems and working on them is that you try and eliminate some of the perceptual biases that any of us bring to a particular problem. When you have a manager operating in isolation, making all the decisions themselves, their biases begin to impact the organization in a very profound way.
And they're not on the floor, so to speak. They're not teaching in the classroom or running the widget through the machine or...
You know, the sad news is that every time you elevate yourself one step, every time you move one level higher in the hierarchy, then you probably lose all grasp of reality of what it's like to be at that step right below you because you don't deal with their problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for lack of a better term, you're on a higher plane now. And unfortunately, I think what that ends up causing are situations where managers have, quote-unquote, the big picture but can't see the trees because of the forest and don't understand the real issues and concerns that people have on the front line. And I'm not saying issues and concerns in the personal sense as much as I am in the business sense. They don't understand what's working and what isn't working. Why? Because they don't interact with it. All they see are, you know, aggregate numbers that somehow are supposed to represent the end result. If I could give a challenge to managers, and it's an old challenge that Hewlett-Packard has laid down for years now, it's get out from behind your desk. And if nothing else, take the time to wander around a little bit now and then and find out what the heck is going on down there at the front line. Because that would be another one of the big things that we do wrong is we isolate ourselves. You know, we get the corner office with the big desk and the chair, and we feel like we have to be there to be important. And I would argue that the manager who's spending more than 50 or 60% of their time behind their desk is already a failure, because they're not spending enough time with their people to really find out what's going on. And without that knowledge, how can they be making good decisions?
Two things occur to me. One is that what you have said about the failures of well-intentioned managers could apply to a family manager, which is to say a parent.
Certainly.
A government manager, a public servant or a politician, elected official. An agency or corporation or mom-and-pop grocery store manager. That this is global.
It's universal. In the sense that, I mean, good people skills are good people skills. It really doesn't matter whether they come out of a Boy Scout troop, mm-hmm. or it comes out of an Army unit, or it comes out of a post office branch somewhere, or, you know, the local for the gas readers union, or a school, or a big business, or the boardroom of a Fortune 500 company, or the White House. I mean, good skills are good skills. It doesn't matter where they come from.
And the other thing that occurs to me is that it sounds like in the company you've given us, the goals are going to be different for the person who is isolated, unable to take risks, unable to connect with his or her people, and the people who are making the widgets, teaching in the classroom, producing the manuscripts, whatever. If I'm on the floor or writing the manuscript or teaching the classroom, my goals are to accomplish those things. Where my manager, it sounds like, may be in the office working out a budget, or which may not involve the number of textbooks I need. Does this make sense?
It makes sense. I'm not sure that I 100% agree with you, though.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is I think the scenario you paint is very plausible, and I think it does happen. I'm not sure that I would accept that as saying that that's the norm. Unfortunately, I think what happens is maybe that's where it starts, and I don't know how far you want to go back and say here's the beginning. You know, it's the endless chicken and egg debate, mm-hmm. which came first. Where I think the problem lies, though, is that because the manager becomes so focused on survival, and they become so focused on not making a mistake and not committing an error and maintaining the status quo, then that sense of priorities, as out of tune as it may be with what the organization really ought to be accomplishing, begins to be transmitted down. And so people who are in the classroom, or people who are running the widget machine, or people who are working in the post office, or, you know, on the deck of a ship or whatever, increasingly become concerned not with did we achieve our objective, which was to satisfy this group or that group or do this or do that, but did we survive another day? I mean, I think what it becomes is almost a dog-eat-dog situation where the way to win the game is to make the fewest number of errors.
And if the employee doesn't hear from the manager or supervisor, he or she assumes
they're doing okay. I mean, that's the sad news is certainly there. You know, I'm certain that many of your listeners will be able to identify with you know, the idea that, hey, you know, my boss told me if you don't hear from me, it means you're doing okay. You know, we've taken the idea that non-delivery of punishment is some kind of a reward and turned it into a management philosophy in this country. And to some degree, it's a parenting philosophy as well. I mean, there's certainly been, I think, ample evidence that suggests a lot of kids grow up resentful because they don't get the attention. Why? They do everything right. And it's their sibling who does everything wrong. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's always going to be a tug of war there. And do we take the time and the opportunities to really recognize people when they do something right, as opposed to looking for the mistakes?
Well, now that takes us to good management. Again, for those who've tuned in late, we're listening to Sam Boyle, who is a management consultant and a trainer, the head of Boyle Consulting Services. He works in link with, as an associate with, Blanchard Training and Development, Inc. When you teach, you frequently teach based on the one-minute management method. Is that fairly accurate?
It's one of the principal programs that I do.
Why does it work?
I think the real strength of one-minute management has always been its simplicity. You know, in fact, some people have even thrown that up as some sort of a shortcoming. The magic of one-minute management is that basically what Ken Blanchard did is he took I would guess 60 or 70 years worth of research into human behavior. Certainly everything we've done since the Hawthorne experiments under Mayo. And he condensed it into a formula and said, do this. And rather than worry about giving you the background and the philosophy and the nuts and bolts and understanding of why it worked, he just said, do this. And so what he's given managers, and for that matter parents, teachers, or just about anybody who finds themselves in a role of working with others towards common goals, is he's given them a simple formula that says, if you perform these tasks for your people, the odds are your people will in turn give you these outcomes. And so it's almost it's almost a push-button approach to management. And I'm not so sure there's anything wrong with that. I think one of the big criticisms was that, and to some degree still is, especially in academic circles, is that I guess for lack of a better term, it's not a sophisticated enough model. Mm-hmm. And yet, sophistication be damned, it works. And the issue then becomes, if it makes us more effective, and it makes our people more effective, and everybody in general appreciates and understands each other better and is more willing to work towards the common goals, then it can't be so bad.
Let's take a cliff note look at the one-minute management model for those who don't understand it. To my understanding, there are three parts. One is you set goals for yourself and your employees or whomever. You give positive feedback and you give negative feedback, and there ends the book. This is it, yes.
That's, in a nutshell, the original book, which was The One-Minute Manager. Mm-hmm. Basically what Ken did is laid out a system for establishing expectations with people through what he calls a one-minute goal. And the one-minute goal, and that's a catchy title, and there's no doubt about it. There was probably a little bit of slick marketing at work there at some level. But where the idea one-minute goals came from is that it should take a person about a minute to read a good goal sheet, which Ken defines as 250 words or less, or about a page, handwritten. And the idea is to encourage people to stop and look at those goals now and then and reread them and look at their own behavior and ask themselves the question, am I doing the things I set out to do in the first place? So I think, unfortunately, zillions of people set goals every year and then make zero progress. I mean, how many of us are familiar with the concept of New Year's resolution? And why is it we go back and make the same promises year after year after year? We never do anything to actually stop and check, are we doing the things we set out to do? Ken's idea was that if you gave people a document that said, here are your goals, in a very condensed format, stop now and then, read them, think about what you're doing, then odds are that in and of itself would get some people on target, simply by giving them something to serve as kind of a refresher. And I would contrast that. The average expectation or experience out there, I think for most workers, is that if they get together with their manager to discuss goals at all, it's a once-a-year event. It's usually done in the wake of their performance appraisal for last year, which is not exactly the happiest of times for a lot of people. And so what they end up feeling like is, oh, they've been given another laundry list for next year, mm-hmm. which is probably going to be used to beat them up with at the end of the year. And Ken's idea was to kind of step away from all that and say, hold on, let's really sit down and think about what's important for this person in their position. What are 2, 3, 5 things, tops, this person ought to be focusing on for the next 6 or 12 months that really are going to make a difference to the organization? And then to put that in writing and make a commitment to it as a manager and say, yes, these are the priorities, which is not to say that they won't change next month or 6 months from now because of changes in the environment, but simply to say that as a manager, I'm not going to flip-flop around on you. I'm going to stick with you and stick by you and say, these are important things, and I want you focused on them, and I'm going to commit that I'm going to help you with them. Where one-minute management's been expanded is that we've really kind of looked at the issue of how do you then get people to think about what they're doing and hopefully acquire more skills to be able to accomplish those goals as you go along. And the way that we've done that is by incorporating situational leadership into the model. In the past, one-minute management was thought of as being the goal setting, the praising, and the reprimand. What we've now added to that is the idea that we certainly need to start behaviors or get people going in the right direction with goals. But you also need to have a system for coaching people day in and day out on the job to make sure they've got the skills to be able to give you those behaviors. And situational leadership is simply the idea that we can stop and take a look at how our people are doing in relationship to their task and then interact with them in ways designed to help them build the skills and the confidence they need to be able to go out and perform the task. And then you would factor in that issue of being able to deal in the consequences, being able to either administer appraising or reprimand as people need to kind of keep them on target over the long term.
This makes great sense, and I hesitate to say it makes great sense on paper, but I'm going to. I can hear people, managers, and probably employees in the listening audience who are saying, come on, first of all, I got to set goals with this person. Then I have to coach this person through their job. Give me a break. I have quotas to meet. I have 70 employees or 45 or 30 employees. I have two departments. I have problems of my own.
What's the alternative? I mean, that's the challenge. There's no doubt that we can sit here and come up with a zillion reasons for why we shouldn't do anything, regardless of what it is that we're discussing. So the question becomes, what's the alternative? It seems to me that the alternative is that I'll follow the standard procedure. The standard procedure in America, government, corporate, whatever, is, and I'm generalizing, so we can all find exceptions, but you know, I hire somebody into a position, I take them around, I introduce them to 6 or 12 people they're going to work with, I show them where the coffee machine is, the break room is, I show them where the restrooms are, I show them the desk of their predecessor, I tell them to settle in, kind of look around, get the feel for things. We'll get together in a week or two and we'll talk about their objectives. Odds are I never keep that appointment because I've gotten drawn away by a crisis that's come up somewhere in the organization. This person kind of muddles along for the next year. Maybe if they're lucky, I floated them a copy of a job description that I've had from the office for the last 12 years that nobody's ever followed. At the end of a 12-month cycle, I pull them into the office, I sit them down, and I give them their performance appraisal, which could probably best be described as an independent autopsy. Because what I do is I slice them and dice them because they haven't done half the things on a job description, which it makes no matter that no one else has done those things for the last 10 years. I, as a manager, am so out of touch that I don't know that. And then I'm shocked and surprised that these people are demoralized and demotivated for the next 3 months and basically don't produce. Now, my question is what's the alternative? Is that really such a wonderful system? How many managers out there are terrified to take a vacation? How many of them are worried about leaving the office for a day? How many managers out there live in fear of what next crisis is going to pop up next? What's going to be the next issue they have to deal with? And the reason is because they've never invested the time up front to clearly communicate their expectations and then work with people to help them achieve the expectations. It's the classic pay me now, pay me later. You know, you can certainly avoid all this in the beginning. You can throw out there the what you want people to do. You can demand their compliance. And you'll continue to pay over the long run because you'll be jumping from one crisis to another, putting out fires.
Whereas if you do this, you take some risks. You let the employee in on a great deal more than you would have in this other management situation because they now know their goals, the company goals, what's expected of them, and they have some coaching to do that. So they're a little more independent, right? So you take the risk now that you've sent off someone who is not under your control. Is that a concern for some managers?
I think a lot of managers are terrified of losing control. But that's understandable in the sense that all the role models in their lives have been based on control.
And because they're fighting fires constantly, so they have to stay in control.
Certainly.
Right?
And you know, I think organizationally we've reinforced that. I mean, I would not want to give off the impression that there are a lot of managers out there who are just god-awful ogres and who've independently arrived at these conclusions, this is the right way to manage. Let's acknowledge that they were conditioned to manage that way. I think in 1946, the classic example was the strike at the Philadelphia plant for General Electric. And I believe Lemuel Boulware was the name of the senior VP for human relations. When the strike ended, his comment, the quote was, I believe if something happened, it must not happen again. Somehow, somewhere, the employees got the idea that they were in the driver's seat. You know, this is an attitude that must be reversed. You know, this is the fantasy that must be eliminated. Now, first off, of course, your initial reaction is, how does a guy like this get to have the title Senior VP for Human Relations? I mean, clearly there's an issue. But I think you have to put it in context. And in context, in 1946, Lemuel Boulware was not out of touch with his times. I believe the overwhelming majority of managers in 1946 would have agreed with that statement. My question then becomes, who trained us? Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at today's crop of managers, who taught us what it meant to manage? And what we acknowledge is that we learned skills from people who believed that control was a model. And if you want to, I mean, you can look at that and you can, look back to the Industrial Revolution, where most of our modern management thinking came from. You know, the average supervisor or manager in the Industrial Revolution was faced with a complex task of keeping an assembly line going. It was very hazardous working conditions. The hours were long. The workers were either quasi-literate or illiterate at best, generally from a dozen different nationalities. Only a handful of them could even speak English. I mean, the person you picked to be the supervisor, the manager, the boss, was the biggest, burliest guy on the shift. That way, if nothing else, he could whop the heck out of somebody and get their attention. And the point, of course, is that our models have perpetuated, even though our circumstances have changed. And so I think, you know, when you ask the question, how did we get here, I think it was natural. And I don't think it was evil choice on anybody's part. The question is, how do we now break that pattern? How do we get out of that chain? And I think that begins by acknowledging that control is no longer our goal. Or maybe that we control through a different means.
One of the things you're implying with this first facet of situational leadership is that if you train your employee, if you set goals with your employee, if you train and coach your employee will become more independent, then presumably that employee will be able to fight his or her own fires.
Without needing you to fight the fires for them.
That frees you up to manage more differently.
Well, I think differently might be a better way of putting it than more. I would hesitate to be an advocate of let's dump more on the manager, although that is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, you have to stop and you have to look at what's going on around us and what's driving people to change. Most of our management thinking in this country has always been based on the concept that the span of control, which is the number of workers you have for every one manager, has always been roughly 8 to 10 to 1. The idea was that for every 8 to 10 workers, you had a manager or supervisor. Well, that led to the bloated bureaucracies where we had, you know, layers and layers and layers of management. And it's very difficult to be competitive when you've got layers of hierarchy in the organization. I mean, witness, if you will, you know, a contrast. I think Toyota operates in the United States with about 7 layers of management. You know, Ford's got 17. General Motors, by contrast, depending on which plant you're in, has either 21 or 22 layers of management between the shop floor and the CEO of the company. Well, the point I'm making is, it is obviously infinitely easier for a 7-layer organization to respond to a situation or to a change in the environment than it is for a 17, much less 22-layer organization. And so the question becomes, what do you do about that? The answer that we've seen all across America in the last 5 years is downsize your management. It's not a fad. It's not going to go away. It's here to stay. Because it's one of the ways that we can improve our competitiveness against our global competitors, is we learn to move faster and quicker and make decisions in a more timely manner. What that means for many individual managers is that they're no longer going to have 8 to 10 direct reports. They're going to have 20, 30, or 40 direct reports. You physically cannot supervise 40 people the way you can supervise 8. You don't physically have the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the answer is yes, that allows us to do more, not in the sense that we're out there physically doing more ourselves, but that we've broadened our reach. We're able to handle a larger number of people. And I think that's a big change.
Now, how does that jive with the positive-negative feedback idea? If I have, as a supervisor, 20, 25, 30 or more people under me, how can I spend the time to give all those people both positive and negative feedback?
Well, first off, I'm not sure that everybody needs feedback every minute of every day.
Mm.
I think that most people need feedback on a periodic basis. And what I mean by that is people have differing needs. For example, if I'm a beginner, if I've just come to work for your organization, then I'm probably going to need a lot of feedback and a lot of hand-holding in the very beginning to get me up to speed. If I'm a seasoned veteran and I've been around for 5 or 10 years, then odds are I'm probably not going to need a whole lot of feedback because I should be confident and self-assured about what I'm doing. I should be competent in the tasks that have been assigned to me. And so I would think that the manager would be able to kind of judge based on the circumstances and the individuals who needs what in their organization. The key, of course, is if the manager is not caught up in the constant ongoing crisis management that so many of them have come to see as a way of life, they've got the time to look around and see what's going on, acknowledge the people who are doing things right, and occasionally find the opportunities to correct the people who are doing something wrong. And I would clearly think that would probably be something that would consume less than 10% of their time.
So that act, to give either positive or negative feedback, a reprimand or a compliment, tells the person at the level at which they're working where they are, that you noticed, and that implies, I suppose, that you have even higher expectations of them. So you now have a worker who's charged up by a positive response from the supervisor and willing to do more for the company?
Well, I think, you know, the big danger here is that people perceive that as being manipulative, and it's certainly not meant that way. You know, I think it's important to put it into context. What do people want? You know, survey after survey after survey in this country for the last, again, 60 or 70 years. I mean, again, go back to Hawthorne and work your way forward. Study after study, you know, what have the behavioral scientists found? Well, in 70 years, what they found is that every time they ask, they get the same answer. When people are asked, what do you want, in, you know, in context of the organization, the number one answer isn't money, it isn't time off, it isn't vacation, it's, I want to be acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
I want somebody to recognize me for the good things that I do. And I think that strikes a deep chord in all of us. And so when we talk about the praising, what we're really talking about is taking the time to give people the acknowledgement that they've earned, that they deserve. So the danger is looking at it as being manipulative. If you acknowledge that it's not manipulative, that what you're really doing is giving people what they want, then certainly that encourages people to probably give you more in the future. It encourages people to go out and try a little bit harder next time, because everybody likes to be perceived as being a winner. I mean, I have yet to meet anybody who was indifferent to praise. Some of us probably don't show it as much as others, but all of us like praise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just a natural consequence that somebody who's acknowledged for the things they do well is probably going to continue to behave in the same way in the future. And you know, the implications are that that's the best, fastest way to teach anybody anything.
I mean, you did good.
Yeah, you did good.
Right. Which encourages, give you something else to do, or better to, or harder to do, or.
Or well, I mean, it encourages the person to go back and try harder next time,
mm-hmm.
and see if they can see if the people then become competitive with themselves, which is the ultimate form of competition. You're no longer doing it for someone else. You're no longer doing it because you want something that somebody else doesn't have. You're now doing it because you want to make it better for yourself. Now, you can't find a higher form of motivation than that.
Now, what about a reprimand? Isn't that going to make the employee want to curl up and go away?
Well, I hope not. I think if a reprimand's handled properly, what it really tells the employee to do is stop and think and ask themselves, what have I done? Why did I do that? How can I make sure that doesn't happen again?
I'm not calling you a jerk when I'm reprimanding you then.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, most people's expectations is that a reprimand does result in them being called a jerk. I think our traditional view of a reprimand is that's an excuse for what I like to call a managerial temper tantrum. Somebody jumps up and down, they scream and shout, they throw things, they call people names. They're obscene, they're rude in their behavior. And somehow we've come to condone that, you know, at some level in the organization and some level in our society, for that matter, that we permit people to get away with that kind of behavior. And the reason why I guess I get on such a soapbox on that issue is because it wouldn't be so bad if at least it was productive, but it's not. I mean, the purpose behind any reprimand or correction is that the person who's being corrected or reprimanded will hopefully make a change in their own behavior. Now, obviously, you or I, if we're in the position, be it as a parent or a teacher or a supervisor or a manager, if we're in the position of reprimanding another human being, we cannot choose for them what behaviors to display in the future. The most we can hope to do is influence their selection. So that means that the most you and I can really hope for is that we can get them to think about it. Because let's face it, you and I cannot make the decisions for them. So my question then becomes, what is it you and I can do that will actually influence that person to think about themselves and their own behavior? Well, one of the worst things you can do is mm-hmm. a traditional reprimand. If I jump up and down, scream and shout, and call you all kinds of names and otherwise engage in boorish behavior, then what have I really accomplished? When it's all over with, you're thinking about how rotten I was and how I've mistreated you, and you're not thinking about your own behavior at all. What purpose did that serve?
Got us all distressed. In just a couple of sentences, what's the ideal reprimand?
I think the ideal reprimand is a reprimand that gets the person to think about what they've done wrong, without allowing them to feel like they're under attack, that they've been threatened, without making them feel like somebody is putting them down.
So the manager says, I had these expectations. You did not meet them in these ways. And that makes me as the manager feel or makes me have to do this and that, and I don't want to?
I think you could even boil it down a little bit less than that. I mean, I think what you're really saying is that, one, here is specifically what you've done. Two, here is what that means to me. Three, I think you're better than that.
Oh.
Because I do think it's important that people understand you have an expectation that they're going to do better next time.
Uh-huh.
That they are valuable, that they're a resource that you count on, that you're going to continue to count on them, and that they, in turn, only need to change their behavior a little bit to get back in sync with what you expect from them as the manager. And I think that can be communicated in a very non-threatening and professional way.
And that leaves the door open for the positive feedback the next time.
Certainly.
Yeah, you really did that well.
You haven't set up a confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, to some degree, you could even say you've avoided confrontation. Because what you've done is told the person what needs to change without allowing them to get defensive in the process.
We're listening again to Sam Boyle. He's the head of Boyle Consulting Services, a traveler. He teaches management training and development techniques, all in the area of personnel management. And he is an associate with the Blanchard Training and Development Company, started by Ken Blanchard of One Minute Manager fame. You mentioned at the beginning of this program, and it also a little while in, that the 21st century is going to bring some changes, that we are going to be a far more internationally focused...
We already are. We just don't know it yet.
So what does that mean? I assume that the economy is changing. We know that.
You know, it's staggering. And this is, you know, you'll have to be careful. This is a topic I can warm to real easily. Only because so many people, I fear, and maybe I'm wrong, but in traveling around and talking to people, I fear that so many people are not paying attention to what's going on around them. And they're not, and I, you know, I don't, none of us has a crystal ball. None of us has a patent on the future. I certainly don't. And don't claim to have extraordinary insight or knowledge. But I the kinds of things that I'm noticing are certainly not, revelations. There are things that anybody who takes a little bit of time to really think about what's going on in the world around them ought to be noticing and paying attention to. And I think what's important is to look at the economic implications behind them. You know, everybody runs around ranting and raving about the Japanese, and yet the statistics say that the Japanese are not the issue. I mean, it is true that they've made some terrific inroads into our markets in the last several years. On the other side of the coin, you know, the Japanese, for example, in investment in this country, although we rant and rave about it, do not account for anywhere near half the foreign investment made in this country. For example, last year the British invested more dollars in this country than the Japanese did, which, I mean, almost makes one wonder if there's a racial element to this, that we only dislike it when it's somebody from a different race than our majority culture. You know, people talk about automobiles incessantly and the Japanese inroads there. And again, I'm not diminishing that. It is significant. The other side of the coin, though, is that many people don't stop to think that we ran a larger trade deficit in electronics last year than we did in automobiles. I mean, the country that invented the VCR almost doesn't manufacture them any longer. We're almost out of the business of making color televisions and microwave ovens. And it's kind of fascinating to look at these. I mean, these issues, you have, you know, I come from Detroit, and you have, you know, the UAW campaigns and says, you know, we shouldn't buy Japanese cars. And yet I don't know any of them who are willing to give up their Sony televisions. I mean, it's all interrelated.
Okay, if we're not looking in the right place, if we're looking at someone who's buying up our country, buying up America, where should we be looking? What is our blind spot as a nation?
I think our blind spot is that we always try and come up with some reason for why we're not doing well. And typically, we like to position that so we're not at fault. And so, for example, we've created the myth of the Japanese Superman and the Japanese super manager, super company. You know, the idea that they're all-knowing, all-powerful with these wonderful techniques that simply can't be beat. Well, that's a myth. You know, in the first place, Japanese management, while it is certainly unique, is not a panacea. You know, several instances it has worked marvelously in this country. In several instances it has failed miserably. And the track record is probably no better, no worse than ours. And I think it would be important to note the Japanese management is really an outgrowth of American management because they came to this country and studied our techniques at the end of the war and really took our techniques back with them and applied them. So really probably the real difference between us is the cultural difference. I think we have a tendency, once having created that Superman or super competitor image, to desperately try and live up to it by doing our own worst at times to shoot ourselves in the foot. And again, there's countless examples of industries in this country that have done exactly that. And unfortunately, the last straw is that we then resort to protectionism as a way of trying to preserve some small piece of the status quo. And unfortunately, that's counterproductive. Probably the last major protectionist movement in this country, whether we want to take responsibility for it or not, probably caused the Great Depression in the 1930s. I'm not sure that we really want to precipitate another disaster. And the interesting thing is that how do you stop it? I mean, for example, probably a significant chunk of the American products, quote unquote, that we buy today were actually manufactured overseas in foreign subsidiaries. I think I caught the newspaper the other day and a significant, 48-49% of our oil is now imported. I mean, if you suddenly start saying, let's live without the imports, what do you let go of? And I'm not sure that we would even be able to do that in the future. So the question becomes then, how can we do something better with what we've got right now? And I think that means learning to look at what's going on, and rather than try and position that as being something that is either one, an out-of-control event that we cannot influence in any way, or two, we try and position it as being ho-hum, that's the same thing we've seen before. I think we need to start positioning things in terms of what's really going on. I think we need to let go of our blinders to some degree. One of my favorite lines is that Ike will never be president of the United States again. We'll never own 104% of the world market share because Lord knows we did at one time. We're going to have to hustle.
In the 21st century, what can an individual do, or a sharp company if it's the same, to hustle for that competitive edge?
I think that a company or an individual, and I think it would be no different for either one, has got to learn how to learn. I think the future belongs to a learning organization and a learning individual. A group of people or a person who is capable of constantly absorbing new ideas, new information, new approaches, new techniques, and then applying them.
Very flexible.
Yes, incredibly flexible. The model for the organization of the future is that probably it's going to become more and more of a hollow shell.
Translate.
I think what you're going to see is maybe I'm trying to think of a good role model or a good illustration. The building contractor will be the role model of the future.
Oh.
The idea that you have a small core of executives and skilled workers who keep your organization focused on its goals, but you then bring people in or move people out as situations change.
Lots of experts who can do the hammering and nailing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The subcontractors who will come in to actually perform the nuts and bolts tasks to make things happen in the organization to give you your advantage in the marketplace, however fleeting it may be. The organization that learns how to do that is the organization that will thrive. The individual who learns how to be flexible and live within that chaotic system is the individual who will prosper into the future.
And what are the best managed companies in the nation today? Who's just out there doing exactly what you think they ought to do?
Best managed companies in the United States today. Put me on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
I like Ford. I like Ford a lot. Ford has a long way to go. Clearly have made their fair share of errors. I'm impressed by them because they are simply so much further along than either a GM or Chrysler in terms of turning themselves around. American Airlines, undisputably probably one of the best service organizations in the country. They've come out of nowhere to be, if not number one, then at least number two in the marketplace. And the joke right now, if you ride airplanes as frequently as I do, is that, one of these days American's going to own everything. And it wouldn't surprise me. Because even though they've grown, they've never lost sight of what made them grow in the first place, which was their customer. Fabulous job.
Same thing with Ford. So they're keeping an eye on the customer.
Ford lost the sight of the customer, no doubt,
uh-huh.
And for a long time. And I think has really done a great job recovering in the 80s. and is moving ahead. Some of their latest designs are fabulous. Their quality is far superior to what it once was. Boeing, certainly a prime example of everything America is capable of.
Another company that was in desperate trouble 10, 20 years ago.
Yes, Boeing, yes. Yeah. In fact, almost down and out. Uh-huh. And has you know, now leads the world in commercial aircraft deliveries. There are a handful of others. Hewlett-Packard, I think, is always going to be on the top of the list. I'm a big fan of Nordstrom. I think they do a lot of things incredibly well, despite what you may or may not hear in the press from time to time. Gore and Associates. You know, Bill Gore just ran an absolutely fabulous organization. Unfortunately, Bill's gone now. But, I mean, Herman Miller, you know, Max
Furniture
Dupree's company.
Maker,
yes.
Yeah. Max Dupree, incidentally, is the author of a marvelous book called Leadership is an Art. If people are interested to see how that company works, certainly it's a wonderful book.
Must-read list.
So some of these companies are our Fortune 500 companies.
Certainly.
Some of them are leading.
Some of them.
I have one last question for you, and it's unfair because we have moments left, but I'm going to throw it out anyway. We have witnessed in the early part of the 90s the discovery of an enormous crisis in ethics in the SNL industry, as well as in other parts of business and government. What are our greatest ethical problems in business or in any facet of enterprise? And are there things we must do to turn our ethics around, whether we're in a small company or a major corporation?
I think the biggest challenge that we face ethically is acknowledging that winning is not everything. And unfortunately, our society right now rewards winners and does not necessarily reward honesty. And I think perhaps it's time we do something about that. And I don't have a panacea for that. I don't have a formula. I know there's a lot of good people who are struggling with the issue. I think that overall, we're going to have to culturally come to terms with this in short order. I mean, you know, for better or for worse, the SNL scandal is certainly growing and it's absorbing the national attention, although to some degree it's a diversion. I mean, at the same time we have the SNL fiasco, you know, we witnessed the recent behavior in the halls of Congress. I mean, we have a congressman who basically paid a prostitute to live with him for a period of time, who, you know, is given a wrist slapping by his colleagues. He doesn't even lose his seniority. We have a senator, you know, who illegally accepted over $100,000 worth of income. And again, we see a wrist slapping, you know, response. And I think my response to them is how can they possibly hope to raise the issue of ethics to any of us when this is the best they can achieve? And it's universal. We have sports figures going to jail. We have politicians. I mean, business people. Where does it end? Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately people are going to have to start demanding a higher standard of accountability from our organizations, from our leaders, from each other.
Top to bottom.
Yeah.
Sam Boyle, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you.
Once again, for people who are interested, we've been talking to Sam Boyle. He runs Boyle Consulting Services, travels around the world, helping people to manage their organizations better, to develop better management techniques, and to train themselves and their people in management. We've been talking in this hour as well about touching on Kenneth Blanchard's work in the One Minute Manager, one of his books. Another of his books is The Power of Ethical Management. Recommended as we went along, a book by Max Dupree, Dupree, called Leadership is an Art. Talking today about management on Conversations. Thank you for being with us. I'm Susan McInnes.